I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s,
she looked like a million bucks,
scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes.
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old Richmond because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart for a year, and what a year it has been. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Make Woke AF Daily your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
But I can remember being at halftime, being down 28-3 to that team and thinking, I made the wrong choice. Like every other turn in my life, I screwed it up, you know? Hi, my name is Chris Long and I have a football podcast. I used to play football for a living.
Year, everybody. New year, new me. No, not really. It's still off the beat, and I'm still your same old boring host, Brian Baumgartner. My guest today, well, is true NFL royalty, Chris Long. He is, of course, former professional defensive end with 11 years in the NFL on the Rams, the Patriots, and the Eagles. He has two Super Bowl rings and the prestigious Man of the Year award to show for it. But when I say royalty, I mean football. Well, it runs in his blood. He comes from a long line of NFL greats. Long. Get it? Nailed it. His dad, Howie Long, also has a Super Bowl ring with the former LA Raiders. His brother, Kyle Long, Chicago Bear, longtime offensive lineman, and his other brother, Howie Long Jr., works for the current Raiders organization in Las Vegas. The NFL is full of Longs. Well, guess what? Chris, he's the first and only Long to ever be on this podcast, so that is very special for him. I know. He also hosts his own podcast, Green Light, where he talks about sports and culture and all kinds of fun stuff with really great guests. Not me yet, but in addition, he's currently a host on the long running Inside the NFL. But first, he's going to be my really fun guest on my podcast. I know he is honored. Here he is, the hard-hitting and very funny Chris Long.
Bubble and squeak, I love it. Bubble and squeak, I know. Bubble and squeak, I cook it every morning, left over from the night before.
What's up, Chris?
Brian, how you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm great. It's good to meet you. I'm a big fan. I've enjoyed watching you talk football, too, so.
Oh, really? Do I hold up okay?
Yeah, dude, you know what you're talking about. You're interested in your team, and I know you know Rich a little bit, so.
Yeah.
I go on his show every Monday. He's treated me really well in this space, so great guy. Well,
you've made it work for you, that's for sure. Yeah, I think he's a great guy. Dan Patrick as well. And
he's awesome.
You know, I'll tell you this. They've had me on to host some on the Good Morning Football there on the NFL Network.
Yeah, Schrager.
And I'm serious. If it wasn't for that lifestyle change, like I love where I live now here in Southern California. If it wasn't for the New York and the like 4:30 a.m. wake up calls on the East Coast time, I would love to do it. I have so much fun doing that.
Yeah.
I don't know if I know what I'm talking about, but I have a great time.
Yeah, but you know, I don't know if I know what I'm talking about week to week, and I'm watching a million games. So it's like the great equalizer. You're watching football. It's hard to figure out. And I'm with you, dude. That's the reason I do my operation out of my hometown. So I don't have to be on one of these shows that my alarm clock goes off at 5 a.m. Not for me. Also, not like I couldn't live in New York. It'd be hard.
So where are you?
I'm in Virginia. I'm right outside Charlottesville. I don't know if you've ever been to UVA.
I have.
Yeah, it's I've grew up here mostly. So
well, I know that. We're gonna talk about that. But I will tell you, I'm just slightly older than you. My best friend from high school went to UVA and I saw Dave Matthews there.
Did you really? Yeah. Well, I saw Dave Matthews 2 weeks ago running through the friggin' park. Like actually one of my producers, his sister works with Red Light, their management company.
Okay.
And you know, he's like, he's still around. He kind of does regular guy shit, which I love. And their live shows are great.
Yeah. He's awesome. Well, look, I want to talk about your newfound job and success, but I do want to start back a little bit to your beginning there where you still are. Charlottesville, Virginia. Now, when you were growing up, your dad, spoiler alert, that's Howie Long, was playing in the NFL for the Raiders. Were you traveling a lot with him or not so much?
So really, we moved to Virginia as soon as he retired. And I spent the first eight years of my life living in Southern California. I lived, we lived in Redondo. And then we moved up in the world as dad got bigger paychecks and we moved to PV and we moved out of that haunted house in Redondo, legit haunted house. Lived in a haunted house. Yeah, it was crazy. I had like an imaginary friend that my mom claims is actually a ghost. Name of the ghost was Nicey. So dad couldn't wait to get out of that house. The paycheck got bigger. We moved to PV and then he retired. And we moved across the country because my dad's from South Boston. Like you've seen the town and
right.
That's kind of like what he grew up in is Charlestown. So he didn't have like a super easy upbringing. He didn't have a place to like just go back to. So we looked at a couple places and I guess he played golf in Virginia and kind of fell in love with it. And yeah, that's where we moved. So, but when he was in Oakland, because he was like the last Oakland Raider in that first installment of the Raiders in Oakland, you know, like it was interesting growing up going to those games because you had to be careful taking your little kid to a Raiders game, even if he had like Raiders clothes on. It was just, is a rough scene. And so, you know, just growing up in that was really cool. But also getting to meet some of the people that my dad played with, like my parents never made it like a big deal. My dad just kind of tried to make it seem like, hey, I'm normal. I have this job.
Here are my coworkers.
Yeah, they're my coworkers. Bo Jackson is in the kitchen. Right. It was just Bo Jackson. And like, he never really overemphasized it. So I had a lot of cool experiences while my dad played. That not only it was cool as a kid, but it shaped the way I thought about having kids during my career and when I wanted to do that, you know, seeing him come home beat up, stressed. And now I'm sitting there in my eighth year in the league and I'm saying, I'm glad I waited because it is hard. We waited to have our first son, Waylon, until I was like 31 years old.
Right.
And I think part of that, what shaped that is being a kid whose dad plays in the NFL. It's great. But he'd be the first to tell you, man, hey, sorry, it was hard. It was hard to do both jobs, be a dad and be present as a dad. And when I get home, kind of put work on the back burner. So, yeah, I spent 8 years as an NFL kid and then we moved to Virginia.
Well, I mean, I have to ask the obvious question. Did you ever try to introduce Nicey to Bo Jackson? I mean, did you try to introduce Nicey around or
no?
Was this more a private thing?
This is a private thing. It's spent a lot of time in the house with me and my mom, you know, mama's boy. My mom was practicing corporate law until the third kid came along. And, you know, back in the day, it was me, mom, and dad was at work 12 hours a day plus. And, you know, I think I needed a friend, and I found one in this house. Now I know where the house is. I kind of feel like going back with one of these ghost hunters.
With you. I know. I want to go with you and find out.
She swears it was a ghost, dude. She was like, it wasn't an imaginary friend, man. I was pointing to people in the room. It's bad.
Do you think it was a ghost?
Yeah, absolutely. I believe in that stuff. Do you believe in that stuff?
I don't know. I suppose so. Why not? I don't know.
Yeah.
A lot of people certainly believe it, so they're likely not wrong. I mean, look, no one who has seen it doesn't believe it.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's the thing. You need a friend that you trust to see it, to believe it.
Right.
You know, like I'll hear some celebrity that's like, I got pinned down in my bed. I'm like, yeah, well, do you have a book tour coming up or what's going on? Like, if it's a friend, I'm more apt to believe that friend. And I think my parents, to be honest, when we moved to Virginia, we moved to this house that was from the 1860s. You know, there's a lot of these old brick houses. That one's haunted too, man. I don't know what it is. I don't think my dad has the antenna for this, but I do.
So here's the thing. I'm going to say something, and I'm not going to mention any show names because I don't want to get in trouble. God, am I going to get in trouble? I needed the nicey story. So I got asked, I have never told this. This is probably not good.
Tell it.
I was asked to be on one of those shows.
No way.
Like a haunted experience show. That's all I'll say. And I was like, has anything weird ever happened? So I told a story there was no definitiveness for me.
Yeah.
Like, am I sure what this was or whatever? I told a story. It's long and boring, apparently. And I was told by the producers, you know, can we make it a little more? A little more ghosty?
Can we make it a little more? Can there be a ghost punchline?
Yeah, can we make it a little more? Yeah, a little more ghosty or a little more hauntedy. And I'm like, you know what? Just like, I'm out. I wasn't sure I wanted to do this to begin with, but I can't.
I feel like you're exposing an entire industry.
Well, that's why the
implication here.
I know. That's why I'm treading very lightly, because I don't want to get in trouble or get on someone's naughty list this time of year, but that did happen.
Well, honestly, we're talking about doing some content around here where I take like some of my old teammates places and we do some crazy stuff. And, you know, like one of the ideas we were kicking around was like spending a night in various of the most haunted places in the United States and seeing if these big, tough guys, we turn the lights off at night, who's gonna leave the house first? So if we do one of those, you know, this is a no frills, no BS ghost show. We'll have you on if you ever want to take me on.
All right. I'm in. I will say this. The New Orleans thing.
You can feel it.
You can. Yeah. And you hear the stories and you're like, whether they're embellished or not, whether there was a producer many, many years ago that told them to beef it up a little bit. But when you're like, well, if 25% of this is true, like there are things walking
around. If 10% is true, all it takes is one ghost for me to believe. So if it's 1%, I think I'm there.
I wonder about that now, too, you know, with kids. Like, you know, at what point, you know, you're young at this point.
Yeah.
But like you're talking about like, oh, there's Bo Jackson in the kitchen. And it's like, let's go visit dad on set and there's Robin Williams or whatever. And you're like, you know, how that shapes a person, shapes you. For you, and, you know, we'll talk about your career, but like, is it early on that you're like, I'm going to do what dad does?
It's an interesting question because I think it does shape who you are. I think in a lot of ways, especially if you go into this vocation like I have, because immediately, whether you know it or not, you're being served humble pie. I mean, my dad's got a gold jacket. You know, like I go to league, you know, I have a really good career, one that I'm proud of, but you're never going to, you know, the chances of you doing that are pretty low. So in my house, you know, I come home for Christmas break or for, you know, whenever it is and come back to my hometown. I'm at the dinner table with Hall of Famer, you know, Pro Bowl guard, Kyle, my brother for the Bears. You probably watched him play once or twice.
Yeah.
And we're on the right side of those games. But,
yeah.
And then it's me. And, you know, like the point is we all had good runs in our own right, but I never walk around like my shit doesn't stink because I have evidence everywhere that it that it doesn't. And, you know, like from a very early age, like it's just reinforced how normal it is. So the NFL was thrilling to me. I wasn't motivated by the experience. I was motivated by trying to succeed at something. Like the lifestyle, you know, some of the highs, they never got to me. Maybe like they could for somebody else. And I think it keeps you humble, but it also keeps you from enjoying some of the big moments at times, because you're like, you know, a lot of the guys I play with, you go back to your hometown, you're like the one of one.
Right.
And everything you do in your career is framed in the context of your dad's a Hall of Famer. Are you going to live up to that? Are you going to be that? Are you going to, you know, and then being drafted high, it's the same thing. And so I think it's always been a challenge, but for some kid that grew up with no resources and didn't get looks coming out or whatever, like I'm sure, although they could empathize with my plight, they have their own plight, which is way different. And right. So I think no matter how you get to the NFL, it's kind of a miracle. I mean, there's so many kids with that dream. It was never a dream for me early on because I was just into other stuff, and my parents didn't steer me that way. And I think my dad did a really good job of, you know, hey, you can be whatever you want to be, but his whole thing was like, you better bust your ass. So if you're going to be an engineer, like I better see you building some bridges, buddy. And like, right. You know, like
right.
Whatever it is. And so I think it shaped me for the better. It also took some of the enjoyment maybe out of my career, being honest. I loved every minute of it, but in a twisted kind of way. Like I love the challenge of it. You know, I like to know what I'm made of, and I got more out of that in the NFL than I did probably just be like, man, I'm living the dream, because I've seen what that's like. I grew up in it and it's more normalized for me.
Well, it's interesting. You know, you have three brothers.
Yep.
And Kyle, as
you
mentioned.
Two brothers. Yeah, three total. Yeah.
And, you know, Kyle playing on the offensive line guard for so long. You are playing essentially the same position that your dad played.
Yeah.
Who is a Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
But there's something else interesting about your dad, which, I mean, maybe this is obvious. Maybe this is so dumb.
Maybe not.
Maybe it's obvious. Well, it doesn't take anything away from his playing career. So let me be very clear. I don't want to piss off any longs, but
no, he's not the one that's going to get pissed off. He's pretty secure. And I mean, no. You get that mustard jacket, you're good.
No, but what I'm saying is that he now is elevated because he's also still every Sunday on television.
And like, because he looks like he's 31.
What's going on with that? But you see him every week and you're like, yeah, he could still play.
Yeah.
It's weird in that, I mean, he's an amazing player. He's got the mustard coat, Hall of Famer, but also he's just still in our consciousness.
Yes.
And it's like, even though, you know, I was very young when he was playing and I don't have specific memories of his dominance, I also grew up with him.
Yes.
And even kids who are 12 today or whatever, like
they still know who he is.
Aware of him and his, you know, the shadow.
Yeah.
Which
no
you're
question.
Having to live in, you know, to this day.
Well, it's funny story. Like the older I got in the league, when I got in, it's like, yeah, you're Howie Long's son. When I played high school football, it's Howie Long's son. If I had an accolade that I accomplished, it was, hey, it's because you're Howie Long's son, or you get a scholarship, it's because you're Howie Long's son, or whatever it is. When I got in the league, I could feel that pressure and it followed me intrinsically. Like that's just who I am. I feel pressure. I tried to convert it into output. You know, that's just the way I operate. It's not the healthiest way to operate. You know, I said to my dad last week, because we were in the hallway. First, he congratulated me because he saw my podcast was the number one podcast in the country. It's not true. He just saw somebody's Spotify Wrapped. So he didn't really understand the Spotify Wrapped thing. And he was like, yeah, you beat out Joe Rogan. Good job. Like, and I'm like, nah, dad, but the whole thing is, you know, I've realized, and part of it is just being his son and you know, nothing you ever accomplish is good enough for other people. So eventually it's not good enough for you. I kind of came to grips with the fact that I'm not a miserable person, but I'll never be satisfied. And I think that's been a tool that's helped me. It hasn't helped my quality of life, but it's helped me and the guys in here are laughing because they're my producers and they know I'm never satisfied. And that's a gift and a curse. And you get it from that situation. But my dad did such a good job transitioning into the next act. And for a guy from South Boston who had, you know, an accent, grew up in a messed up situation, really brilliant cat, but not like a, it's not like he went to Oxford, to sit in that chair for now 25 years, and maybe it's longer, that group, for him to be the constant through Ronnie Lott and, you know, like James Brown and a mm-hmm. bunch of guys, Chris Collinsworth, you see where he's been, and dad's just been steady. And that's the kind of guy he is. That's why I respect him so much, because you know what you're going to get. He is who he is, and he's not going to be try to be something he's not. And I think in football, he helped me a lot because he's the same way as me. I'm thinking about the Super Bowl I played in a couple years ago that we won with the Eagles. And instead of it being 100% joy in my head, there's a big 25% of me that wanted to get the ball off Tom Brady. You know, and that, and I can't get over that 25%. And it's a real thing.
Wow.
And, you know, that's the way my dad was. He's looking over his shoulder at somebody trying to take his job, or, you know, he was that poor kid from South Boston.
Right.
And I didn't grow up that way, but he passed that paranoia on to me, and I'm the oldest son and that sort of thing. So he's helped me a lot after football too, because he stuck the landing on that thing, which is hard. And I think retirement's hard for athletes in general. I mean, we've seen evidence of that at sure. every turn, but for him to make that transition and get in on it before the space was too crowded, and he's a fixture. And as these guys age, I mean, at some point, there'll be other guys at that desk. And same right. thing with CBS or whatever. But when I watch him, the rare times I do turn on the TV on Sunday to watch the pregame show, because Kyle's on TV too, I don't want to pick a favorite. Like, dad does not, he doesn't fall off. I mean, because he never overextends himself or tries to be something he's not. And I think people appreciate that about him.
Absolutely.
When I'd walk out of a game in the tunnel, he knew exactly what I was thinking. Everybody else is patting you on the back, but he knows that one play. Or on a day where maybe you had a great game, but you didn't get a sack or whatever, he knows you played well. We might get yelled at on Monday, but that guy knows everything about how I'm evaluating my situation. He can give me that one piece of advice, encouragement, or that, hey, Swift kick in the ass of like, dude, you need to be better setting the edge this week. I know people are patting you on the back about this, but I see it. And so I appreciated that at every turn. That's where it really helps. Where it hurts is going to make you feel the pressure. And for some people, it crushes them.
Right.
You know, and it almost did it a couple points in my career and my life, but I'm better for it.
He obviously was, as you just mentioned, giving you some specific advice.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit, though. You know, you mentioned the diverse activities that you were doing. I mean, baseball, basketball, lacrosse, yeah. obviously football. Talk to me a little bit about the influence and impact your high school coach, John Blake,
oh, yeah.
had on you.
He's the man. I just texted him the other day, and I said something similar. I mean, like, you know, I got an honor for something here, and he was congratulating me. And I was like, well, it helps I had a pretty good high school coach. And, you know, in typical John Blake fashion, he's like, well, when you have good players, you know, he's just not the type, you know, when right. you think about like the prototypical, you know, the dramatized version of a high school coach, is he's the legend in his own mind. It's like Bud Kilmer from Varsity Blues, but this right. guy is totally different, soft-spoken, somebody that for me, and it's not just John Blake, it's also Al Groh at Virginia. And for a young person, even with a lot of positive male role models in my life, like my dad or his friends or, you know, some other folks, these coaches are so important. And John, for me, he used to read us a poem called Man in the Glass, and I can almost recite the whole thing. I mean, I can. And I used to, I don't know if you ever heard it, but it's about looking in the mirror and satisfying that person in the mirror. Mm-hmm. And of course, I still haven't found a way to do that. But if you get pretty close, you'll be okay. And if a high school coach leaves you with one thing that you take with you throughout your life, I think that person did their job. And I just have the utmost respect for that vocation and teachers.
Right.
You know, because young men especially, we need the extra help. And I was one of those guys that I wasn't a great student. I knew I was smart, I guess, but, you know, I struggled to make the grade. I struggled to stay focused. I've had ADHD my whole life. I've talked about it on my podcast recently, finally doing something about it, taking some medication for that. But like, that was really hard for me growing up. And so for a person like John, who just was like the ADHD whisperer, and I always say in D-line rooms in the NFL, it's like a daycare center. The biggest, baddest dudes, but we're all children. You know, yeah. it's a zoo in there. You have to have a certain kind of teacher that can manage young men. And, you know, John was amazing, and I'm still friends with him and Mary and his kids, and it's pretty awesome. I mean, having guys like that in your corner.
Well, he was obviously doing a lot right. This, of course, was at St. Anne's Belfield School there in Charlottesville. 2003, your senior year, squad goes undefeated. You play your last high school game in the state championship. You win the state championship. You walk off the field. No better feeling as a young athlete than that?
Yeah, no better feeling. And Brian, like I've always been somebody that like tries to overappreciate the moment because I just see it kind of slipping. I just do. Like time's precious and being where you are is precious. And no matter how much you try to slow it down, it's not stopping. And I think that's where you just stop and smell the roses. But I can remember sitting on the stairs and being like, this is really it. I can remember a couple of those things throughout my football career where you're like, I cannot believe, whether it's walking out of the Superdome a couple years ago, and I hadn't decided that I was going to retire yet, but I had a feeling when I took my helmet off, this could be the last time I put on a helmet. I haven't had a football helmet on, something I did every day my whole life since I was 14, like most kids, but then I get to play to 33, 34 years old.
Right.
Like that's your life. And, you know, every chapter, as the page turns, you got to stop and think, you know, and I think for me, all I remember was the bittersweet feeling of, man, this was like stuck the landing on this thing and I'm committed to Virginia. I get to go down the street to school and all this stuff. And man, what a cool run it was. But there was a guy, Rashad Jennings. He played 10 years in the league. He was a 250-pound running back, I swear. He was like an A.J. Dillon kind of guy, you know? Yeah. He was playing running back in high school and he hit me harder than I've been hit my entire career on the sideline there in the state championship game. The first time I ever stayed down in my entire career, I stayed down probably 10, 15 seconds. And again, I'm walking out of the stadium and we're state champions. And all I could think about was getting knocked on my ass in front of 200 people or however many people were at the game.
Right, right.
So, you know, at every turn, whether it was like St. Louis, the last game, that was weird, man. You know, like we were kind of, I'm sure we'll get to it, but we were moving. We knew we were moving. I knew I was getting cut. I'm playing on like a broken leg, like trying to come back, look terrible. We're playing the Bucks. It's a color rush game. So it looks like ketchup and mustard. It's disgusting. It's the last game at the Edward Jones Dome. You know, now they're doing monster truck rallies there.
Yeah.
And I just remember thinking like, this is it, you know, and sometimes it's ceremonious, like your high school state championship. And sometimes it's like unceremonious in a big way. And you don't know how to feel about it. And I just think as a football player, you have a bunch of those moments and you just try to soak in the moment and be present.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Why'd you go to Charlottesville? I mean, look, you end up playing in the U.S. Army All-American Bowl out of high school. You're, you know, kicking ass. Your team is great. You likely, whether you'd say it or not, you could have gone anywhere you wanted to go. Not only do you decide to go to Virginia and be called a Wahoo, which is still...
Yeah. I can try to explain, but...
Yeah, it's fine.
It's supposedly a fish that can drink its weight in water, some multiple, like three times its weight in water or something. And we took a lot of pride in being huge drunks, I guess. so I don't know.
Wahoo! So not only do you go there, but you decide your junior year. Was it just a hometown thing?
Honestly, this is cathartic because it kind of feels like there's a theme here, but it was because of my lack of confidence. I just thought, I took my first offer. I went down to Virginia and Al Groh had a big Super Bowl trophy on his desk from when he was with the Giants. And, you know, this is this guy that my dad speaks highly of and my high school coach speaks highly of. He's a pro coach. And I didn't know what I wanted at that point. I didn't know if I wanted to play pro ball. I just wanted to do the thing. I wanted to do the thing in front of me. Like, I wanted to do the best I could at whatever I was doing. I wanted to play baseball for a while, but I couldn't hit the curveball. So that's going to be a problem. And, I think the weights ended up being a problem there. And so I ended up just committing to Virginia. It was the first offer I got. I remember watching Florida State play at night and thinking like, oh, that'd be cool. This is back when they had so many great players and they do again now. But I thought, honestly, I don't know if I could play there. And when you have a dad who's so honest with you, I'll never forget this story. And he always says, I never said that, or you're misrepresenting it. So sorry, Dad. But when I was a junior, I got a letter from like all these schools and I got a couple Ivy League letters and he was like, hey, now we're talking. He goes, I don't know that you're athletic enough to play end at the D1A level. Like, I think you could be a killer guard. And that strategy eventually worked on my brother. But I just, I think the humility of the whole thing and the doubters and people, you know, I listened to it when I was younger. I was like, all right, well, I don't want to take this chance and go far away from home to some program where I might not be good enough. And I think Al and laundry, home cooked meals, like the security of it. I'm a safe bet guy.
Yeah. In case you see Nicey again.
No, Nicey's in Cali. That's why I didn't go to USC.
Just in case, mom's there. She'll help you out.
Yeah.
I saw an interview with you when you were in college. You mentioned going up against not just a man, the man, DeBrickashaw Ferguson. Ooh. There in practice. Did he make you better?
Yeah, but sometimes you go against somebody that good, you can't work your stuff. Like, you got to survive, right? Like, his arms were so long, you reach out and touch me from 5 feet away. And, you know, we ran like a 3-4, which means, you know, I'm an inside shade of the tackle, as you know, in a 4-eye, and I'm trying to get a pass rush from that position. It was just like having a dance partner for 6 seconds of play and he wasn't letting me go. It was like, and not just him, but Eugene Monroe and Brandon Albert, like that entire group, because Al was so pro style. Like, so we recruited big guys. We had big front seven, big linemen. We weren't as good on the back end. The parallel would be Lane Johnson in Philly. Okay. I really do think Lane, and Trent Williams gets a lot of credit. If you like Trent or Lane, like, I'm not going to argue either way. But as a pass blocking tackle over the last 10 years, I'm not putting anybody above Lane Johnson. And when I got there at 32, 33 years old, and I had to practice against him every day, it felt like DeBrickishaw again, where right. you're like, this is great, but I can't actually try stuff. I need to rep different moves.
I need to practice.
I can't practice. You're too good. So, yeah, it was tough sometimes.
I mean, you bring that up. Defensive linemen get a lot. They get a lot of money. They get a lot of talk. Secondary guys, corners, the same. Obviously, you got quarterback, wide receiver. But you look at, you know, what happened in San Francisco when Trenton was down.
Yeah.
And when Lane is maybe not quite healthy or whatever. Yeah. Like, the impact that those guys have.
Yep.
Obviously, Bakhtiari for a long time at Green Bay.
Great player.
Same deal. And as much as they talk about them, people like your dad on television, it's still, no one thinks about, no one goes there. And you're right.
What's happening
with the Jets this year, too. And it's like, well, they're not scoring because of this or that, but also, like, they got to protect.
No question. You know, like, when San Francisco had that dip, people were looking at, hey, Debo's not out here. You know, you're missing.
Right.
I forget who else they were missing. But the most important thing, I think
Ayuk.
But the most important thing in that whole offense, because of the way that offense runs, is the tackle that can allow you to do so many things in the run game. Not just he can cave a three technique on a double team. He can get out in space and you can watch a 10-minute highlight tape of him running over DBs like cones in a parking lot, like
just and bouncing.
And then these guys can't even cut these guys anymore.
Yeah.
And so it's like, how do you want me to play Trent Williams in space? I'm giving up 150 pounds. And it's, we make a big deal about the pass pro, right? Because when a guy's missing, you can see, hey, the Eagles don't feel as good. Jalen, immediately in that Bills game, Lane's down with a groin. Immediately, I'm seeing Jalen check that side a lot, which is taking his eyes off his progression. You know, like, you might not be getting pressure, but it is affecting the ebb and flow of that quarterback's process.
Right.
And I think the same way in the run game on a team like San Francisco, they're so dynamic because they stress every level of defense. You have to respect every key. Not only that, but they have personnel groupings that all look the same. You know, like, you can run little guy sets with big guys, and you can run big guy sets with little guys, right, because you have interchangeable pieces. And the whole thing, really, when you think about it, stems from that hard run action to the perimeter. And the way that they live there is because they got that big SOB out there who might be the best at his position of our generation in every phase. Now, having said that, I think Lane should be in that conversation too.
Sure.
But when these guys are missing, it's not just the simple, oh, he got sacked a lot, or they couldn't run the ball. It's the entire offense, which is predicated on both things working. And I think San Francisco, you bring up a great point, is a perfect example.
Yeah. At what point when you're at Virginia do you go, I'm going to the next level? When do you know?
Honestly, I think it was a spring game, maybe my second year. Like, my first year, I struggled, you know, being so far away from home, 10 minutes. That was hard for me. And then on top of that, I think it was just the scheme. I was in a 3-4. You know, like, when I was 18, I wasn't thinking about that stuff. You know, right. I think kids now are so much more educated because of these camps and because of the process. I just kind of took things as they came. And, you know, the scheme wasn't perfect for me, but, and Coach Groh was tough. Like, it was like a shock. But I liked him, and I came close to transferring my freshman year. I looked at Cal and Ohio State, and I got right to the cusp of, like, doing it. And I just was like, no, I'm not a quitter. I'm going to stick it out. And, you know, I don't want to be that guy. Now, in today's day and age, maybe I'd have bounced because it's just so much more normalized. But
right.
I stuck around. And then my second spring game, we come out there, and I think I had like 3 sacks, and I just felt like things were coming together for me. And I said, I might be able to play. And then my junior year, I had a really nice year. I can remember distinctly huddling around the kitchen table with my dad and his, like, business advisor, who was kind of going to help me a little bit. And that's where the stuff really helps to have a dad, you know, that been through it, the business acumen, the contracts, the process. And we're sitting there discussing it. In the NFL, if you're a junior and you send in your draft grade, I don't know how much it's changed, but we looked at the draft grade, which was the bottom of the first draft grade. So I was, if they said, if I came out as a junior, I'd probably get picked 30th or, you know, 28th. My dad was like, take the money, man. You know, I had Anthony Poindexter on my staff, who was one of the greatest football players I had ever seen and would have been like Ed Reed had he not torn his knee to pieces. And he's actually the DC at Penn State now, doing a great job. But he was one of the best football players in Virginia history. He came back his senior year, and I can remember being a little kid on the hill, which is the hill up there where you get kind of GA tickets. And I remember going, not a little kid, because I was sneaking across the street to drink like vodka out of a Deer Park bottle. But when I got back in the stadium, I was like, where's Anthony Poindexter? He was like a god, and they carted him off because he was back, and I think they played NC State, and he took a chance, and it backfired, and he lost generational wealth because of that.
Right.
He was like, yeah, look what happened to Dex. You know, like, hey, buddy, you can't take chances here. And the same thing went for his buddy, Steve, who said the same thing. And I said, guys, like, I got to bet on myself here. I think I can do more this senior year. And I just remember coming out that senior year as a team and as an individual and being like, this is an all or nothing year. And I put it together. I had like a really good year, led the country in some stuff and went to some award banquets, and it was like a dream. And our team, we won like 5-7 close games. They called us like the cardiac Cavs. So whether it was UConn or Middle Tennessee State surviving on like a block field goal, we almost got stranded in Murfreesboro after that game. If we had lost that game, it'd be terrible. We're sitting on the tarmac for 2 hours. It was just a magical year. And I'm so glad I did it. I'm so glad I take the chance. But I also had the safety net to do it.
Yeah.
And anytime I've talked to younger people about like big decisions, like, hey, when I go talk at my kids' private school, you guys have huge safety nets. So take chances and do them balls out.
That's a really good point.
You know, it's not the same. I wouldn't walk into a inner city school where kids are first generation college kids, or walk into a school where a kid kind of grew up that way and say, hey, you got to go, you got to stay here and be loyal to your family. So it's easy for me to say, hey, loyalty, 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 take a risk. That was just what worked for me, and it paid off, and it paid off a lot because I got picked in top five and made a lot of money.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really mature and astute observation there. It's tough. You have to look at the totality of the situation. And if you don't have a safety net and you're in exactly the same position, you're like, I could be drafted 30th. Yeah. That's incredible.
Better team too. Could have been a Packer or something.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah. I know. God. 8 years in St. Louis.
I would have liked that. It worked out well for you. Dudley Award winner. Given to the top NCAA football player in the Commonwealth of Virginia. 2007 ACC Defensive Player of the Year. Won the Hendricks Award, which is the top award given to a DE in the nation. Unanimous All-American. You received a first place vote. Here's a question. For the Heisman, does your dad have a Heisman vote?
No, there's a couple things he doesn't have. Now, he might have that. He might have a gold jacket. He might be getting royalties for Firestorm and 3,000 Miles to Graceland. Or he might have been in a movie with Tom Hanks, which I forget the name of that one, but it was pretty funny. Actually, in one of the deleted scenes, he's supposed to be Tom Hanks' boyfriend. And that's like a subplot in the whole movie. What's it? That Thing You Do. It's a movie. Okay. Exactly. What movie is this?
No, I
remember. He might have all these things, but he doesn't have a first place Heisman vote.
Yeah. Have you been told who voted for you first?
No, but I'd like to drug test that person. I really would. I'd like to go back and see how much drugs that writer was on, because I appreciate it. But yeah, no. And it was cool because we had a lot of storied dudes that I went to all those banquets with. Glenn Dorsey and Matt Ryan and you know, Vernon Golston, if you remember him. Like, there were some really good players.
You get drafted second overall, and weirdly, the second long to be drafted. You go to St. Louis. Do you think you're going to be in St. Louis forever? Like, is that your mindset, just like Charlottesville? Like, are you like, here I am, I'm a lifer, I'm going to Derek Jeter this, or whatever? Yeah. Like,
I think I really did take things... And it sounds cliche, but when you're a kid and you get dropped into a situation like that with all that pressure and, you know, if you get picked that high, your team's going to suck. You just know that. I mean, like, you know, I remember.
So interesting. Yeah.
You know, yeah, I just thought of things as like, everybody was like, what an accomplishment. And I just knew as soon as I walked onto that podium, like, I got my work cut out for me, because for you to justify being picked that high, it's hard. And then to do it on a team where things aren't good, it's even harder. Like, it's just not going to be an easy road. And I remember getting on the elevator in New York after the draft, like during the draft, and I got on with these two big dudes, and they obviously were like Rams. I think one was like Leroy Glover, and these guys ended up being my best buddies because they were like my big brothers. But at the time, they just glared at me and they were like, get ready to get to work. And, you know, like, I'll never forget that elevator ride, because I already knew I had to get to work, but seeing the grown men that I was going to be either cutting into their snaps, rightfully or wrongfully, or being depended upon, like, it became a whole nother level of accountability. And I learned a lot, because in the old NFL, the CBA was different. So we actually had two-a-days. We had training camp proper.
Right.
Guys today, I hate to sound like an old guy, they don't deal with that. And then on top of that, there were a lot of older guys in the league, because now in today's game, they're too expensive.
Right.
You know, and I thought this was just the way it was always going to be, but I learned so much even through the 1-15, 2-14 seasons. And I saw so many people come and go. So I don't know if it was the fact that, like, at times it felt like I was there 100 years because nobody else was there as long as me. I can remember my equipment manager, Jimmy Lake, joking like 5 years in, like, I think a coach yelled at me once, like in front of the team, and Jimmy was my guy. And he's like, you're going to be here longer than all these motherfuckers.
So
and I was like, I don't know if it's a good thing. But it turned out to be true, because, you know, like, we were so bad and we cycled through so many people, and then Jeff Fisher came and we were close. But by my eighth year in St. Louis, my seventh year, I had the closest parking spot to the building, which means that, like, I'm the oldest guy. I'm 29, 28, 30 years old. And so the NFL changed a lot. And I did love St. Louis. In fact, my wife coached at John Burroughs.
Okay.
Where Jenna Fisher from The Office went.
Yeah.
So I met her, and I met John Hamm because he went there too. It's like the who's who. Ezekiel Elliott went there.
To the school?
Yeah. Yeah. My wife coached there. So we really made a lot of inroads, man.
Like, do you know John Hamm taught there too? Do you know this?
I guess so. I guess I found out afterwards, but I've seen him at Bonnaroo and then like in Vegas, just randomly at the Wynn, like checking in. And every time he's super cool. And he remembers me.
He's a very nice guy.
He's a great guy. It's unfair for be that good looking and be a nice guy. Why can't you be an asshole? Yeah, but like, we really made roots there. Like, I love the blues. Like, we went to the sporting events. I had my favorite bars. I'd go to the same places. I'd kill to go back to one of these places in University City or a bar in the Loop. Like, I love St. Louis. Brett Hall. I used to drink with him at the cigar bar at the Ritz. Have you hung out with him?
Oh, yeah. He's a good buddy of mine. He's a good buddy of mine.
He's awesome.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I mean, it was great. I loved everything about it, but we just couldn't win. And I hated it for those fans because I lived in a hotel my eighth year.
You knew you were leaving.
Yeah. I was captain of the team my sixth, you know, year, my seventh year, I think. And, you know, like, I was one of the guys. Like, I was playing really well. And my career was doing this, and I got hurt 2 years in a row, and, you know, tried to play hurt, and that never ends well. And my eighth year, by the time I came back from the second injury, we checked into a hotel because I knew I'm getting cut or the team's moving. And it was a super weird year. And that was the year of Tampa Bay game, that last game at the Edward Jones Dome. It was eerie. You know, it's like I did feel like I'd been there for a lifetime. And it feels like a lifetime ago now.
It's interesting. There's a show, I don't know if you ever went and watched it, All or Nothing, where they do this series. And there was an All or Nothing about the Rams their first year in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And Fisher ends up getting fired and things are not going well there at all. And I ended up working on it. That's a long story for another day, but you know, one of the things that was very clear was how difficult it was just the move, just operationally, and everything is temporary. Here's a temporary practice facility and a temporary stadium. And where am I going to live? And where are my kids going to school? And what's the traffic pattern when we have to go to practice? And all of those things they were just really difficult.
It was tough. And I think part of the reason conspiracy theorists will tell you that part of the reason Jeff was hired was to orchestrate a move because he had gone through that with Houston, Tennessee. Right. And St. Louis fans will tell you that that team was kind of stolen from out from under him. And I would agree. Like, I would agree in a lot of ways, but I don't think Jeff was necessarily complicit. I think Jeff was just doing his job as a coach. And Stan wanted, you know, he wanted the Olympics in L.A. He wanted, right. like, and sometimes that's just, you got to realize with these guys, they're not thinking like us. They're business people.
Right.
The more money they can make, no questions asked, that's what they're doing. You know, it's a chart that tells you decision A or B. It's like, follow the money for these guys. And so St. Louis never really had a shot. And now they actually have Super Bowl parties in St. Louis without the game on. Which I think is just, that's how spiteful they are. And I totally appreciate that. And it's also put me in a weird spot, Brian, because I played 2 years in Philly. I loved everything about it. I really clicked in that city and we won. And so, of course, I'm passionate about the Eagles. My kids love the Eagles. Like, it's a family right. thing. My wife's from South Jersey. My parents went to Villanova. But when I don't give that same love to the LA Rams, people get kind of butthurt about
aggravated.
It.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with anything other than the fact that, like, hey, I played for 8 years in St. Louis. It is a fundamentally different thing. As much as I'd love to follow the team,
sure.
and I still have some friends. I talked to Aaron Donald this morning, actually. I love some of those people, the trainers, the Les Snead, the guy who cut me. I had him over for dinner, Les Snead, the next summer. I have no ill will, but it is a different thing. You know, when the franchise moves, it doesn't feel like the same franchise.
Sure.
And so that was tough. Actually, on that show, I don't know if you remember the guy that loves mermaids. William Hayes, he doesn't believe in dinosaurs.
Yes.
He's like my best friend. He visited me like 2 months ago.
He talks to Nicey.
He definitely talks to Nicey, but still.
He still talks to Nicey.
I grew out of it. He's still talking to Nicey.
Yeah. We talk about Philly. You go to the Patriots for 1 year. Shocker. You win the whole thing. After years of losing, now it's got to be fun to be on the other side of it. Not only that, you win in overtime, the biggest comeback in the game's history. By the way, I'm from Atlanta.
Yeah, I saw that. Do you care? Are you like a Falcons fan? I thought you were a Packers fan.
Well,
complicated.
Here's the thing. It's got to be kind of like for you too, maybe in a way, not exactly. I'm not comparing myself to you. I do root for my friends. So, I mean,
yes.
I started as a kid, I was a Falcons fan, of course, and I have gotten to know, you know, Matt Ryan quite a bit.
Great guy.
And great guy. It's weird because I think for like, I wasn't going to every Packers. You know, I would go once or twice a year and hopefully the playoffs or whatever.
Yeah.
But it was weird. Like, there was a stretch there when Atlanta was also good.
Yeah.
That 2 years in a row. And I always like going to Lambeau when it's cold. Like, I like that.
I do too.
And 2 years in a row, they're playing the Falcons. Just like, however the schedule, like, kind of. And so I would be there, you know, before the game or whatever on the field set. And there would be Matt, always so nice.
Yeah.
Coming over and saying hi, or as I'm wearing like the green beanie. And I was like, God, like it was a difficult thing for me. But yeah, no, I was not rooting for you in that Super Bowl.
No, that's okay. I mean, like,
I was not. I mean, you won. So, of course,
I totally understand, because like, I wouldn't have been rooting for me. My, like, I can remember being I've been a big Patriots defender at times because I think like their franchise is amazing. I think Tom's amazing, but I also used to hate him because in college, Coach Groh, he's like from the Belichick tree.
Mm-hmm.
He used to make us wear the stupid striped socks, and we had all the same sayings on the wall and shit. So I can remember being at the bar like, boo, like when David Tyree caught that ball. And then
it's not a catch.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, boo. And then we get to the Super Bowl, and it came down to, for me, in free agency, and I almost retired before I went up there. But I gave it some time. I was like, okay, I want to keep playing. I've never gotten to win. You know, I've never been to the playoffs, never sniffed it. I got to feel like cash in on some of this individual success, enjoy what it's like to be on a team. And it came down to Atlanta
Wow.
and New England. And my dad likes to say, well, I steered him away from Atlanta, but it was the traffic in Atlanta, honestly, for me. It's terrible traffic in that city. I mean, Flowery Branch to Atlanta is like, it's a nightmare. Yeah. I before I got to the meeting with Dan Quinn, I was like, dude, I can't sit in the car like this. But, and he wanted to play me inside. So I was like, yeah, I don't know if I want to play inside, because he wanted me to be his Michael Bennett from Seattle. Like, he wanted me to be the inside outside guy. And ironically, when I got up to New England, that's what I ended up doing in New England, is playing out, like, not in where I wanted to play, anything like that, rushing on the right side, rushing inside. But it was an individually trying year, because I was trying to find my way in that scheme, but also the best year of football I can remember, because the guys on that team, as much as you hate the Patriots, people in general, Devin McCourty, yeah, Jules, Danny Amendola, Ninko, Tom would treat everybody with respect in that building. And I just love the guys, man. And I love Bill. Like, when it came down to the, you know, the end of it, and we finished our parade, and I'm walking back in the building all shit-faced off the duck boats, and I'm like, I'm going in, I'm saying my goodbyes, and there's no hard feelings, but like, I know I can't keep playing here because of the scheme. People were like, yo, you're crazy. Like, why would you leave New England? You were a loser your whole career, and now you want to be a loser again. I just wanted to finish my career playing in a scheme that was more suited for what I do. And I can remember being in the prepping for the Super Bowl, watching tape late at night in the hotel. And I vividly remember this. I'm watching Atlanta, because we watched that team and everybody that's played, and watching Atlanta play Philly in a game at Philly early in the season. And I looked at that D-line and I was like, man, that looks like what I used to do. And at that point, I wasn't even thinking about anything. But when it came time for free agency, I had a buddy, Ian Yates Cunningham, who's actually the assistant guy in Chicago behind Poles. And I played with him in college, and he was in Philly with Joe Douglas. And I just called him. I was like, because nobody was calling me. I was like, yo, do you think you could use like somebody like me? They were like, let me run up the flagpole. And it just all worked out. And so, like, most people, when they leave New England under their own power, people are like, there's something wrong. Right. But there was nothing wrong. I love that place. I love the guys. I wasn't crazy about the sun going down at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. But, you know, as a Southern Cali guy now, you know what I'm saying? But
I do.
But I just needed to make the move. But I can remember being at halftime, being down 28-3 to that team, and thinking, I made the wrong choice. Like every other turn in my life, I screwed it up. You know?
Why did you come back?
Come back to where?
Why did you win that game?
Oh, why did we come back? Yeah. Oh.
Just tell me. Just give me the right answer. Just tell me.
No, really. I'll tell you why. Because I think that sometimes when teams get up on a team and they know the other team's better, and you start like that protection mess up they had with Devontae, I can't remember the running back's name.
Freeman.
But Freeman. Nice. Devontae Freeman.
I got it.
And he let High run free. When they made mistakes like that, they gave us an inch. And when you play a team like Tom Brady and the Patriots in that era, if you give that team an inch, they're going to take a mile. And then the game changes to where the pressure's all on you. And I thought the pressure was too much for that team, that Atlanta team. Mm. I think sometimes you can feel on a team that has a history, or a franchise that has a history of like this thing happening or this thing happening, you can feel those things happening as they're happening. And I think it just snowballed. And then finally, and I think Shanahan should be talked about. We were talking about this week as one of the greatest coaches of our generation, Kyle Shanahan. Because look what he's done with different quarterbacks. You know, you see Andy struggling a little bit right now schematically with the problem they have in Kansas City. Bill, you know, could be just a guy. I don't think so, but without Tom Brady. And Shanahan, as great as a coach as he is, not running the football, up 8 in that football game and kicking a field goal. We knocked him out of field goal range twice with a sack and a holding call. That's the game, you know? And so I think it's a combination of not doing the right things in the right situations, but also just the feeling. Like once that game turned, you could tell they knew. And we knew. Yeah. When we won the toss in overtime, me, Dante Hightower, Alan Branch, and Rob Ninkovich, I said, are we taking our helmets off? And they're like, yeah, take them off. Let's go sit and watch the show. Because we're not going back on the field. And we knew it. And that's how it ended with James White in the end zone.
Incredible.
It was wild. I didn't believe it. I'm not going to act like I believe we were going to win, Brian.
Right.
I'm in the fucking locker room at the half.
And going, why did I make this call? I love
that. First off, I'm like, me and Rob Ninko, because Ninkovich before the game, he's like my best buddy there. He's like, just trust me, bro. You are not going to want to lose a Super Bowl. You're going to wish you went 1-15. You're going to wish you were in St. Louis if we lose this game. And it was just echoing in my head. We go in the locker room and guys are yelling. And I remember Julian being like, we're going to win this game. And I'm like, can we get a stop? Like, what do you know that I don't know? And maybe it's the loser mentality of being in St. Louis for 8 years, but those guys knew.
You talked about it already. You go to Philly. You win back-to-back with two different teams. That hasn't happened a lot. And now you beat the team that you just won with. I mean, it's all weird, right? It's weird.
Yeah.
It's weird.
It was like, I don't believe in karma in the NFL because I've seen too many guys that I loved and respected that didn't get the happy ending at the end of their career. Like where James Laurinaitis, he was right there with me on that turf, wasting his prime. He ends up in New Orleans, his legs fall out from under him, you know, in camp. He just never was the same. And for me to be able to catch those two rides, it felt like a movie. And I was like, I don't know what I did to deserve this, but hopefully it's just my life, my career kind of balancing out. And Philly was so magic because in New England, you were part of a machine and I got to feel what that felt like. And that is a powerful thing. It's like walking into a Bulls locker room in the 90s. Right. You know, like this is sports history. Right. Like these guys do this and right. It's a different kind of feeling. And the leaders, man, Dante Hightower, one of the best leaders, period, I've ever been around. And like guys like that, who the only way you have people like that is having done it. And so that was a great experience. But going down to Philly, getting picked in the bottom third of the league, total afterthought. I thought we could be good, but I had no idea. And losing your starting quarterback, it was like a movie, man. And
yeah, it was.
For it was. The vets, the way it like we kind of converged on Philly, it was like LeGarrette Blount. I start bothering him. I'm like, because he was a guy I liked in New England. Right. I'm like, let's go, dude. And Torrey Smith, the guy that played in the ACC with me, I knew Torrey a little bit. Him calling me, you know, Joe's bringing me to Philly. We should all link up. And then Patrick Robinson. And it was the perfect emergence of veterans and young players and leaders and guys that had been there and guys that had won and guys that hadn't. And we just had something special in that building. I mean, for that year, it was like nobody could stop us. There were better teams, but it's like that day we beat the Vikings at the Link in the NFC Championship. Yeah, I said at some point, anybody could have gotten it that night. And Philly people love hearing that. But I really mean it. There are better teams than us, but I don't know on that night who was beating us because we just had this thing. And you can't manufacture a thing.
Right.
It either exists or it doesn't. And it was the perfect storm.
So you're an Eagle.
Yeah, in my mind. Yeah. Or a St. Louis Ram, you know. But they don't exist. They don't exist.
Right.
So.
How often do you say to Kyle 3-0?
I like to rib him a little bit. We just broke down the double doink game the other day on the pod, which he's become increasingly more level-headed about.
Okay.
But, you know, for a guy that I had to pull out of a fight with my best friend, William, like he was beating my friend up the only time he came to St. Louis. He almost got ejected. After that game, I kind of didn't want to see him in the tunnel because I thought he'd be just dejected. I felt for him.
But 3-0. Do you just walk up to him and say 3-0? That's what me and my buddies do. Like I just played golf with a friend of mine. And I mean, if I just pounded him, we were playing in this little tournament and I pounded him 6-5. I beat him 6-5, which means I beat him up 6 with 5 holes left. I said to him the rest of the day, probably 873 times, 6-5. Six and five.
You know, it's funny because I would rib him, but I also know he's a little sensitive. He doesn't like that shit. And he's also 6'6", 300 pounds, and he could crush me. So like sometimes when we're sitting here doing the podcast and I touch a little button, I'm like, let me take my hand off the button. But I also know which buttons to push. And when we were on the field, I was trying to drive him crazy. He was talking about this the other day. Like I'm a really nice guy, but when I get on the field, I'm going to try to drive you nuts. And especially if I think you're a little bit, you know, like you don't have it wound too tight, which Kyle, when he played, right. I feel like he was a loose cannon. So we'd target him. I'd chirp him and chirp him. And then he beat up my friend and almost get ejected. But then when you get in the tunnel, you're like, hey, there's no referees here to stop him from mauling me.
from killing somebody.
I got to relax.
Yeah. I know I don't have much more time. I got to mention, you're just, I mean, one, you really make me laugh, but two, you're a generous as hell guy. You win what many on the inside consider the most prestigious award that you can win in the NFL, including MVP, the Walter Payton Man of the Year Award. You win it following the 2018 season. In the 2017 season, you played for free?
Yeah, I wasn't making that much now, Brian. But yeah.
Oh, I never thought about that.
So you got to think about it. You know, at this point in my career, they're not paying me as much. But yeah, I played for free, you know?
Why? And
honestly, it started for me. I remember being so on the fence about playing. Like, every year as you get older, the more BS, especially after you win a Super Bowl, you're like, you ask yourself, because I got kids and I'm at that point in my life, like, why am I here? Why do I continue to beat myself up? 2018, I was in line. Now, this is before we started 4-6 off the Super Bowl. And maybe I wish I'd gotten out of line, but I remember getting in line for physicals and I was like, just fucking walk out. You don't want to be here. Be a man about it and walk out. You know, like, don't do this thing that you're half in on. But once I'm in, I'm in. And so I got to the end of the line and I kept playing and I'm glad I did. But in 2017, I was kind of like, every year was like, oh, maybe. And I thought, you know, I want to do something special. I want to do something that's a lot bigger than me and something to ensure that I'm dead serious about coming to work every day, because I didn't know where my head was at. You know, when you're answering for yourself at a certain point in life, you're just going through the motions. You know, you're on a treadmill that never ends. And it's the same thing with being a father or, you know, heading an organization or being responsible for the people that work here at Greenlight. Like, you should do something that's bigger than you. And for me at that point, I wanted to make the world a better place. And I still do, but I had a really big platform. And I thought really hard about just not saying anything about it and just give the money, because there's plenty of people that have given that amount of money before and didn't get a damn parade about it. But for me, I just looked at it like, my pride's going to get in the way of maybe doubling this investment in what I care about. I need to come out and see if these fans will meet me halfway. And they did.
You know, they doubled
my investment in Ed Equity and in the scholarships we were doing. And it was like a springboard for everything we've continued to do. So, I mean, like, those 2 years, we raised a lot of money, the whole thing. We gave a lot of effort in that city and I fell in love with the city. But getting the Man of the Year, I was almost, I'm not even lying to you, and these guys keep referencing them, but they'd tell you, it's not my most proud thing, because I really don't think that's why you do it. You know, like, I said this to Lane Johnson the other day, who's like a little brother to me, mm-hmm. and I love the guy. He's awesome. And he got nominated for Man of the Year, which means he's one of the guys that's going to be up on that stage.
Mm-hmm.
You already won.
You won.
You know, you did the work. You know, the work is why you do it. And
you're getting attention for the charity that you're trying to help as well, which is that's the reason.
That's it. If it's pragmatically going to help us, awesome. You try to do things for altruistic reasons. You know, you're not trying to do it to get. And that was the one thing that made me kind of uncomfortable was, you know, people looking at. And then also standing up on stage with a bunch of guys who aren't going to win. Why am I better than Kyle Rudolph? Why am I better than this guy? Why? So the way I look at it, everybody that gets nominated every year wins. You know, you do win because people care about your stuff more. But the reason I really won was getting a relationship that started with the Walter Payton family. Like, super cool to me to get to know his family, and his family's evidence of his greatness. Everything they've done to continue his legacy. And Jarrett, like his son, been through the same things I've been through with having great expectations. And he played in the league for a while. And we've got a cool friendship now. This summer, he came to visit me in Montana because I spend summer in Montana up there near Glacier Park. And he was like, we got to get together. I'm doing this thing for Walter Payton Man of the Year. We'll do some footage. What do you like to do outside? I'm like, well, I like to hike. So we're going to go on a hike. I forgot to tell him how the altitude was there. But he made it halfway up the mountain. But he came all the way up to see me. And it's just, I got a lifelong friend. And I think I won for that. Like, having been on that stage with those guys, no matter if you won or lost, you're a winner. And so for Lane, for any of these guys, it's just great to be discussed.
One, you're an incredible guy. And I really admire you. I've always admired you as a football player, now I can add making me laugh to the list, which is, I don't know. And, that's, you know, good. To me, that it doesn't get much better than that as well. And you're a good dude. You're crushing it in the media that you're doing now. The iconic television show Inside the NFL.
Yeah.
You're now a part of that. You've got the Greenlight podcast. Is it hard for you to talk about, you know, you haven't been gone that long, so you still have friends that are in the league. Is it hard for you to talk about them or coaches?
Yeah, totally. Every time I get on the mic, I imagine I'm pissing somebody off. And that's the reality of it. And I've gotten better at just being okay with it. You know, I care what people think. So does anybody that has one of these, right?
Like, right.
It's so easy to be like, I don't care what anybody thinks.
Right.
Like, that's the pursuit. But, like, you have to have some, you know, otherwise you wouldn't be doing it. Otherwise, I wouldn't be trying to do the best I very can at it. For me, I just a responsibility that I take seriously to get people the right information, you know? And so whether it's today watching film for 4 hours and sitting here getting ready for the previews, or Sunday night, I'm up till 2 a.m. making sure I've seen every game. Like, I could mail it in, yeah. But I really do care what these people think. And if somebody, by the offhand chance, hears what I say about them, I better be right or fair or frame it correctly. And I think my dad helped me with that, because growing up, his thing was like, I want to be fair. I don't question people's injuries. I'm careful about questioning people's efforts. You don't attack people personally. I'm sure I've fallen short at times because of the casual nature of what we do. It's supposed to be like guys just bullshitting on the couch, and I can fall into that. But I try to be respectful, because I have been in that seat. And there are guys that made me feel a certain way when I heard what they had to say about me, you know?
Yeah, you're doing a fantastic job.
Thanks,
truly,
man.
On the podcast, integrating sports and culture and entertainment. It's a lot of fun to listen to. I wish you all the best in that.
Thanks, Brian.
And on Inside the NFL. And I know you've got Yatehouse Media that you've started, new production company and studio. I can't wait to see what's coming out for you.
We'll see. We got some stuff cooking, but we'll see, man. I'm just trying to make sure the show's fun and I'm enjoying it. So, yeah.
Well, listen, what I hope is our paths cross here very soon. You'll be in Vegas here in February?
You going to go to the game?
I will be there.
All right, let's get together. Yeah, let's get a beer.
Let's do.
Maybe the Packers are in it.
We'll find a time. You think?
The way they looked the other night, buddy. That's really all I said.
They did look really, especially with the injuries they've had. Look, I know we could talk forever.
You got to come on. I'm going to get you on mine one of these days. I'll give you plenty of notice. But I'm
well,
to get
now
you
that
on.
You talked about how I know what I'm talking about, that's an endorsement. That's going to be on my bio from here on out. Thanks, Chris. I appreciate
Thanks, Brian.
It. Chris, thank you so much for being here. I will see you in Las Vegas in just a few weeks for the Super Bowl. Great to have you on here. Guess what? You'll always be my first long. Listeners, check out Greenlight on the podcast app of your choice. Also, be sure to watch Inside the NFL on the CW. I'm going to be back next time with a wish. A real wish that you have a great week. Off the Beat is hosted and executive produced by me, Brian Baumgartner, alongside our executive producer, Ling Lee. Our senior producer is Diego Tapia. Our producers are Liz Hayes, Hannah Harris, and Emily Carr. Our talent producer is Ryan Papa Zachary, and our intern is Ali Amir Sahin. Our theme song, Bubble and Squeak, performed by the one and only Creed Bratton.
I used to have so many men.
how this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.